Omaha Public Radio presents another program from the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. On this Holocaust Remembrance Day, we'll hear a talk by Holocaust survivor Chaya Verveer, a board member of the Holocaust Museum Houston, a member of the Texas Holocaust and Genocide Commission, and president of Child Survivors of the Holocaust Houston. The title of her presentation will be Improbable Survivor, A Young Child in the Holocaust. This program, co-sponsored by the Center for Faith Studies, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, March 6, 2014, for broadcast at this time. The opinions expressed are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of the Institute for Holocaust Education, the Center for Faith Studies, KIOS-FM, or the Omaha Public School District. Here now to introduce the speaker is Liz Feldstern, Executive Director of the Institute for Holocaust Education.
Chaya is visiting us here in Omaha from Houston, Texas, where she has lived for the past 37 years. Before that, her life's adventures included living in Israel, Austria, Brazil, and Denver, Colorado. She led a successful consulting career, working with both for and nonprofit organizations of many industries. She is on the advisory board of the Holocaust Museum Houston. She's the chair of the Child Survivors of the Holocaust Houston, and she is an appointed member of the Texas Holocaust and Genocide Commission. These are the details of Chaya's adult life. Her early life, when the Nazi occupation of Holland spared none, not even toddlers, from its brutality, is what Chaya will tell you tonight. Thank you so much for being here, and thank you for sharing, Chaya.
Before I start, I wanted to tell you how much I have appreciated this week here in Omaha. From knowing nobody, meeting you one time, I have made so many friends here that I feel so lucky and so privileged to have been here. You know how to be warm and welcoming, and it is very, very nice. So be proud of what you have accomplished, and I hope I will do you justice tonight. When I speak or meet people and I say I am from Holland, the first reaction is, oh, Anne Frank. And that's exactly the beginning and the end of knowledge about what happened in Holland. And the interesting thing is that Anne Frank was killed in the end. So it is hard to see where everybody is so joyful, because I think they only think about the love story, but not the end of it all. To give you a little bit of an idea about Holland, there were at one point there were 30,000 people who had come there from Germany, and all before 1939-1940, because Holland was very easy to get to. And it was as close as they could be to their beloved Germany. And because they expected also that should there be a war, Holland would be neutral again as it had been in the World War, in the First World War. So they created German organizations, they had performances, they had movies, they had Little Germantown in Amsterdam. And they felt very good about it, and that is one of the reasons also that the Anne Frank family came. However, when the Holocaust hit in the Netherlands, 107,000 people, 107,000 people were deported, and only 5,400 came back. And that is 80% of the population, of the 80% of the Jews were killed, which is a higher percentage than almost any other country. The Dutch wanted to accommodate. It's a people of believers in authority. The government is always right. And at the same time, people are highly individualistic. So it is a combination of both of them. And it had the highest number of Nazi collaborators and the highest number of Waffen-SS volunteers. At the other hand, it has more people that were recognized as righteous Gentiles than almost any other country. So you can say on the one side it's this, on the other side is that, and it's like most things, it's not an issue of black or white, but shades of gray. So I would have, if the war hadn't happened, I would have had a large, large family, and God knows what they would have accomplished. But my family was wiped out. 342 members of my extended family were killed in the Holocaust. 342. It started out as an ordinary family with ordinary events in their lives. I will tell you as a little issue that happened was that my parents went to Palestine in 1932, so soon after they got married, and lived there. But by then the Depression hit, and my mom couldn't handle the climate that well, and my father couldn't find a job. So they went back to Holland in 1938. And before you tell me that they were out of their mind to go back there, no, because they expected Holland to be neutral again in any war, so what's there to worry? That's like all the Germans coming into Holland because they thought it would be nice and safe there. That's just the tragedy of it. So the German and the British both said, no, we're going to respect your independence. We're not going to do anything. However, the Germans attacked three countries all at the same time, France, Belgium, and the Netherlands. Now, the Netherlands hadn't seen a war for at least 100 years. The last time they were in a war, they were fighting the Belgians, and the Belgians blew up a ship in Antwerp, and the Dutch said, okay, we're going home. And that was the last time that they were in a battle anywhere. So you can imagine, against the Germans, they were hapless. They did their best, but the Germans bombed Rotterdam, which was the second largest city in the country, and they bombed the heart of it out, literally. It was all crumbled up. It wasn't there anymore. And they told the Dutch, if you don't stop and put your arms down, then we're going to bomb Utrecht, which was also another big city. And so the Dutch said, we can't do this anymore. We have to stop. So they did. And first, the German told the Dutch, you know, you are Aryans like us. You have nothing to worry about. You're not like the dirty Poles and all these other vermin. We hold you in high standing. And what they did said, you keep your own government. Essentially what they did, the top of the government, those people were let go, or they had already escaped to Britain. And they put on top their own people or their collaborators. So every rule that came down from Dutch people. It didn't come down from the Germans. The Germans had their hands clean. They just told the Dutch what they wanted, and the Dutch executed it. And so the police would do exactly what they wanted. And the Dutch were very obedient. So it started with regulations in 1940 already, where the segregation between the populations took place. And so it was very slow, and everybody could rationalize that whatever happened at that specific moment wasn't really bad enough to do something against it. And, you know, for example, the Jews couldn't work for the government anymore. Well, everybody said, okay, they can find another job, not to worry about. They couldn't be at the universities anymore. Well, people said, well, so what? They can find another job. Then, you know, the rules came down. You had to register, and a J was stamped on your papers. And the registration, they got the complete registration of the Jewish community. No other country did that. And if you were saying you were a Baptist, they would, if they had doubts, they would go to the Baptist church, and the Baptist, and I'm not picking on them particularly, but they would say, oh, no, we don't know that he is. They didn't think about it. But I give you something to think about, that when you go to the hospital here, they ask you your religion. And you don't think twice about it, because after all, you know that they will provide you with some religious support should you need it. So registration by itself didn't raise that much of an alarm. Except the result was that they knew exactly where Jews were living and could control that population exactly as they wanted. So my father was wearing the Star of David. And that was obligatory by that time. That if they would find that you weren't wearing your star, you would get punished. And it was to be sewn on. You couldn't just, you know, stick it on there. No, that wasn't good enough. You had to sew it on. Should you take your jacket off, you had to have a star under it at all times. So this was at the time that my brothers couldn't go to school anymore. They couldn't have a bike. They couldn't play in the park. They had to, there was curfew. And my father was unemployed. Life was shrinking very fast for us. And you had to have permission also to leave town. You couldn't just take a train or anything. It was not allowed unless, you know, it was something that the government had thought of. So then came the time that really showed the hand of what the Germans intended to do all along. And that was deportation. And the way they went about it is that when you would get a call up to go to the with the train to report, you better be there or else you would be punished. And so there was a Jewish council that the Germans had set up that would decide which people would go, because the Germans made them do it. And so the Jews became the henchmen of the Germans. They were in a nasty situation, because if they wouldn't do what the Germans wanted, then they would and their family would be shipped out. If they did do it, then they committed crimes. against Jews. And what really the situation made it even nastier from that point of view was that if you had relations and protection and knew people, then you could would get a permit to stay out longer. That was called the sperre, and that was the most wanted kind of paperwork that you could get, and everybody wanted to get it. Of course, the lower and middle class lower didn't have that kind of connection, so they were shipped out first. And they were shipped out to somewhere called the East. Nobody knew what that was, the East. But also nobody would get back to them from the East to tell them this, that, or the other thing was happening. It was a good place, a bad place, a this, that, nothing. They didn't hear from them. So rumors started to go around that this was not such a good idea to go wherever the Germans wanted them to go. But what to do? If you didn't want to go and they would find you, what then? So I know that my parents had a lot of discussion going in our house, as in every other house of Jews that had gotten the call up. What to do? Where to go? Should we go where the Nazis want us to go? And what can we do if we don't? Now, I spent a lot of time with the kids talking about the alternatives of going or not going, because I want them to understand what the word hiding means. Because we always talk about, oh, you know, if you didn't want to go, you go into hiding, right? But nobody's thinking about what does that mean. And so I ask the kids always, say, you know, if the person who's sitting next to you asks you to hide them and say they had done nothing wrong, but they had to go underground, and would you do it? So, of course, all the kids say, yeah, all the hands are up there. And then I say, well, I appreciate, and you're good kids, but how would your parents feel about that, with the risk that could be there, that if somebody would be found in your place, then they would be punished too? And if you have a three-year-old or some, you know, a little toddler like that in your house, when you tell them to be quiet and not to tell anything, if they're that age, they go out and tell their friends, because they're incapable at that time to understand what what dangers are. And so every time I ask them to raise their hand again, and it of course starts sinking, then at the last time I say, you don't have to put up your hands, but I tell them that the Germans and the police together did house-to-house searches, and you had to have a darned good hiding place to, you know, escape this. And also, the last thing that I tell them is that if anybody would tell where somebody was in hiding, they would get money. And so people thought that was a nice idea to make some extra money on the side, and besides it, who cares about Jews? So my father had a contact in the resistance, and he asked him, you know, we don't want to go. We have gotten the call up, and anything can happen at any point in time. Can you help us find a place to hide? And he had his contacts, and he said yes. And one night, we left. It is probably too hard for you to see this list, but this, and it's in Dutch, So there's only one guy here who can understand it. So, but what it says is the mayor of our little town and the police are putting out an all-points bulletin for this family that had left without permission. So if you see them, arrest them and report them. So this is, I'm the last on this list, and so at 1 year old, I was a criminal that had to be arrested. Tell me, isn't that something wrong with that picture there? You know, what were they thinking about? A one-year-old is a threat to you? How was that mindset possible? I can't understand it, honestly. I'm being honest with you. When we, as a family of six, went into hiding, you know that they couldn't hide a family of six together. That just was not possible. And so they divvied up the family, and nobody had any say about anything, and we all went different directions. And my parents could not know where any of their kids were going, because the least they knew, the better off it was. So that in case they were captured, they could not reveal anything. I ended up with a family from the Berg who were truly heroic. The family van den Berg was very active in the resistance. They had they had a butcher shop, and under the butcher shop there were cellars, because this was in Leiden. It is a little town, city, which has canals going all the way through it, and when they were bringing in meat or whatever, it would come through the canal in older times. That's how they did everything. And there were, at any given time, in those in the cellar, they had people who were had to quickly change where they were to, because there was a house-to-house search by the Germans, or people got into a fight somewhere and they had to move them. You know, the normal human things. And somebody got sick at the house and they couldn't take care of people anymore. You know, all these things happened in real life. And so they had to move these people. And the family van den Berg had them all in the cellar till the resistance could find another place for them. It wasn't always easy and it wasn't always fast. But they did manage to handle this way. And I was there. They had already two teenage sons, and they would tell everybody that I was a latecomer in the family, and my name became Carla van den Berg. And that's all I knew at the time about who I was. So everything went fine until one day, a young boy, 14-year-old, was captured in an entirely different place. And he was interrogated by the police. And as you well know, we all think we would never say anything. But if it's a 14-year-old who's frightened out of his wits and they want to know something, he's going to talk. And he did talk. So he told them where he was before and before that, and pretty soon he talked about the family van den Berg. Now, the police had their suspicions about the family van den Berg, and they had several times gone into the butcher shop and gone down into the cellars, or what they thought were the cellars, and what they saw was a cellar half full of water. So there was nobody hiding in there. They knew that, so they left disappointed. What they didn't know was that there was another cellar, and that was hidden, and that one was dry. So that is where they brought all those people, and made false ID cards for them, got them coupons, the ration coupons, if anybody's still familiar with that. That was the stamps you needed to have, depending on the number of people in the family, so you could buy bread and all the other essentials. If you didn't do it, you had to go to the black market. And I'm sure that the family van den Berg was heavily into black market trade, because otherwise how were they going to feed all the people they had? And they also, some people in the family started to steal blank ID cards. It was just a cottage industry of anything and everything they could do. But this little boy, this young boy, put an end to this whole thing. And of course, when he told them about the family van den Berg, the police was there the next day. And Mr. van den Berg ended up in Sachsenhausen. And his wife was also put in jail. Fortunately, several months later, she was let go. And me, they took under heavy guard, because, you know, I was still that criminal, as you know. And they took me to a camp called Westerbork. Westerbork was the transit camp from where people were regularly shipped out to camps like Sobibor, like Auschwitz, Bergen-Belsen, all these other nice places. I say that facetiously. And they kept good statistics on how many they shipped out. Berlin asked them to put 200 people on transport, and they would then make the selection. If it was Berlin, sometimes in The Hague, they had a department for that, and sometimes they told them which prisoners had to be sent. But otherwise, the Westerbork authorities could decide who they were shipping out. So again, there was this jockeying for position that you didn't have to go. They had also a strange thing that they did, and that was if a family was there and one of the members of the family was ill, they wouldn't ship that family until such time that that person was healthy again, and then they shipped them out to places like Auschwitz. Does it make any sense to you? No, it didn't make any sense. But in their mind, it made sense, because initially, people were going to be put to work in those camps. So if they were sick, they couldn't work. And the ones that were sick, they had to get rid of. So their thinking evolved over time on how they were going to do all this. In August of 1944, I went to Westerbork. They put me in a children's barrack. The children barrack had the kids that they had found in hiding everywhere, and they brought them there. And what happened that just before I was captured, they had a large transport of all the children out of the children's home shipped out. But I came and some other people came, and, you know, slowly they were still finding the people, and they were still interested in getting them. Even when it was in August of 44, they knew already that they were never going to win this war. But the war against the Jews wasn't over by any means. That would go on till the last day. So in the 9th of September, a large transport, most of the people that were in the camp, left for Auschwitz. Among them, for your information, was Anne Frank. And then on September 13 was the last transport that ever left Westerbork. It had 276 people on board. 52 of them were the children from the orphanage. I happen to have the manifest here, or a copy thereof. It says a group of unknown children. And we all had a placard around our neck, and on it it said what they thought our name was and our date of birth and our age and our presumed names if they didn't know for sure. So they had some names, all the names were with question marks because they weren't sure. I found this manifest when I was living in Brazil, as Liz has already mentioned, and I stayed with a friend because my then husband had to leave town, and I didn't know a soul in Sao Paulo, so except for one Dutch lady, and she invited me to stay with her. And I don't know about you, but I like to read at night. Doesn't matter almost what, but I want to read for half an hour or so to sleep. And I was looking at her books, and I see books in Portuguese. I'm not interested. Can't read that stuff yet. But I did see a colorful book that was blue, white, and red. And it looked like 1940, 1945, so it was something about the war. So I open up the book, and I see some things about the resistance, their pamphlets, then warnings from the authorities, all kinds of stuff. Then I come to a chapter on the Jews. And so I start looking at that. And then I see that statistic that we saw before, and, you know, and the boxcars and everything. And I said, okay, now I was in awe of their, you know, tracking and graphs because they didn't have computers at the time. So they spent an awful lot of time making those beautiful graphs, but they were very important to them. Numbers for them meant everything. And so that they could report to Berlin how wonderful they were doing. When they shipped out a transport, there was a manifest made for everybody on that train. And a copy was kept in Westerbork, a copy went to Berlin, a copy went to The Hague, where the SS had their offices, and a copy went with the guards that accompanied the people that were shipped out. And so that night, I look at this book, and on the left side was that statistical book, and on the right side, it was the group of unknown children. I said, you know what? Maybe I know one of those kids from our youth organization in Holland. And I start reading. Number one, don't know. Number two, don't know. Number three, no idea. And I stopped dead in my tracks because there was Carla van der Berg, my hiding name. And this is the first time I had ever seen that. So that was at 11 o'clock at night in, of all places, Sao Paulo. I couldn't tell anybody. There was nobody there that I could share or figure out what in the world this was, because at the time I wasn't that sophisticated about my background. And it was quite an experience to find out. And it put me on the road to finding out more. Let me tell you about that transport. When they decided to ship out the kids, the people in the camp took one of the boxcars and they put straw on the ground in there. They put some mattresses. They put some of the little chairs and tables from the children's home because there was no need for it anymore. They told the four people who had agreed to accompany us that everything would be hunky-dory because it would only take 3 to 4 hours to get to the destination, Bergen-Belsen. And they were told that was a good camp, and they had got some diapers, some sandwiches, some milk, some water for the kids in the car. And they should be just fine, and they didn't have to worry about running out of things because as soon as they got to Bergen-Belsen, everything would be taken care of. So this train ride that should take 3 to 4 hours took 3 days and night. And what happened was whenever they needed a locomotive, they would just disconnect the train and take the locomotive until at one point or another they would bring a new locomotive. Or the whole train was shunted aside because another train had priority. And so people requested, you know, they said, our accompaniment said, please give us water or anything. And then I think they one time got water. So, by the time we finally arrived in Bergen-Belsen, you can just imagine what it was like. If one kid was crying, the other one started to cry. If they soiled their clothing. I mean, the milk went sour if they hadn't drunk it before. It was an unholy mess. One of the children, a half-year-old girl, died on the way. Probably from dehydration. And when we arrived in Bergen-Belsen, the guards stood ready with their guns. And a journalist from Holland could not believe what he saw. And he wanted to know if these children had been spies for Roosevelt, because otherwise, why in the world would you stand with your guns ready with kids that could barely move and were so stiff and exhausted from this train ride that made no sense to them. But so the other 50 kids managed to be okay there. And we stayed in Bergen-Belsen till November of 1944. And then we were shipped out again. The manifest does not manage exactly the other manifest, but it was the same number of children that were moved, that were sent out from Bergen-Belsen. The original destination for this transport was Auschwitz. It again was meandering around for a while, and one of the older children remembers that at one point the train was being strafed and she was told to jump out into the ditch until they could go again. This train never made it to Auschwitz. Instead, it went to Theresienstadt or Terezin. And that was a stroke of good luck. Because if we had stayed in Bergen-Belsen, the diseases that were there and the influx of people from all over, the Germans were closing camps, make people march to the interior of the country or by train, they were putting them all and Bergen-Belsen was one of the main destinations for that. But they didn't increase the food that was there in Bergen-Belsen. The same food that they had for X number of people, they had to use again for X plus 1,000. And you know what happens in situations like that with very little food and horrible conditions. It was in the winter. And lice and every horrible thing that you can imagine. I don't would have given much about us surviving, really. Had we gotten to Auschwitz, we wouldn't have survived either. No way. They would kill kids immediately. We couldn't make or, you know, we only cost money. So why should they keep the kids? So for some reason unknown to us, and we're still researching this, we ended up in Theresienstadt. Theresienstadt wasn't a death camp. It was actually a place where originally they had kept the elite so that they could exchange them for other prisoners. As a matter of fact, in December of that year, they shipped a good number of the people, and I don't exactly know the number anymore, to Switzerland. They selected out of everybody. They selected out a number and let them go to Switzerland. Haven't yet figured out what they were thinking they were going to get out of that, but they did. But when we ended up in Theresienstadt, we were put in the big hamburger barrack, it was called. And the Dutch women took care of the children. It was, you know, like each country had their own people that they would take care of. And they did their best to try to keep us in, you know, with decent, you know, have enough portions of food to eat for us. And they, you know, they did everything they could. When I asked, because I've met people who were there with me, what we were doing the whole day, she said that most of the time we were staying listless on our mattresses because we didn't get enough food and we most of the time had diarrhea or other diseases. And they also didn't want the Germans to really notice that we were there. So whenever a German soldier wanted to walk in, they would say, oh, no, you don't want to go in. There it is. The kids have whooping cough or whatever it is. And they said, oh, okay. I didn't want to go in there. So we were just hanging around, really. I think that's about the best way I can tell you. So we were there until finally in May of 1945, the Russians finally liberated us. And the people that liberated the camp had absolutely no idea who all these people were and why they were there and why they were in such a bad shape. So they would ask the inmates, who are the bad guys? And they would point and they would shoot them. It was very simple. And that was the first troops were from areas that were not terribly civilized, but they figured out, you know, that we were the victims. Later on, they sent in all their medical teams and kept us in quarantine for quite a while because we had all these diseases. Now, other countries would send their representatives to the camp to come and pick up their people. They would provide for trains, for everything, with the exceptions of the Dutch, because they didn't think it was important enough and they didn't know they were supposed to do that. So the Dutch people in the camp took it upon themselves to take people back to Holland. So we literally got there that everybody took two or three children and we arrived there by plane, train, bus, who knows? And nobody can tell us. We know about a few of us, but we don't know about all of them. So I arrived in Eindhoven, and I was registered there. I was registered as Carla van den Berg, that I was about 3 years old, that I had come from Theresienstadt to via Brussels to Holland, and that was it. The Red Cross would get the names of the people who were registered and would publish it in the newspapers. And that is how my mom found me. So I was no longer Carla van den Berg. I was Gaia Verveer. They put my exact birth date there. And my mother took me back to her home. She knew only about one of my brothers. She did not know anything. She put an ad in the newspaper, said if anybody could help her, tell her the whereabouts of my father. And then she found out that he had been killed, executed by the Germans. And let me tell you a little bit about how that happened. My father was hidden somewhere in the north of Holland, and he had great plans for after he was going to. He was in the building trades, semi-architect. I've never been able to find out what his real official trade was. And after the war, he was going to become a lawyer. He had decided that. And he had his study books to learn. And, you know, he was going to be ready when it was over. And the resistance asked him to help them to draw the fortifications over one of the rivers there. And, you know, and those of you who've been in hiding know darned well, it was either anxiety and scaredness or bored to tears. You went from one to the other, and it was such a strain on you, the tension that was there, because any time, any moment, it could be all over. From that point of view, the camps were more of a certainty, although I wouldn't wish it on anybody. Anyway, my father was drawing the fortifications, and somebody, and we have no idea who, betrayed him. And so the soldiers came on bikes with dogs yapping at my father's legs, and he was transported to a place where they were keeping all the people that were resistance people. At the same time that he was there, the Einsatzgruppe had been kicked out of every country. Einsatzgruppe were the people who were the worst of the worst of the army of the Germans, and they were in charge of terrorizing any resistance and find all the Jews and set examples so everybody would be too scared to do anything. And they were pieces of work, really. And so they decided one day that they were going to teach the people there a lesson. So they went to the prison, and they were in phone contact with headquarters, and they asked who they should take. Now, that the Jew had to be taken was no question. They were going to take him. But they took five other ones. They put them on a car, and they took him to a military terrain, told them to say their prayers, lined them up, and executed them. My father, Emmanuel Favier, age 35, died there. After all these people had been shot, it took a while before the officers gave the local people permission to pick up the bodies. Well, they knew what to do with five of them, but they had no idea what to do with the Jew. There was a Jewish cemetery not too far away, but it had been closed by the Germans, and they were too afraid to ask for permission to bring them there. So they were thinking about what to do. So they decided, you know what, we're just going to ship them back to the place where he came from, Marsbergen, where I was born, and let them take care of it. And when his body arrived in Marsbergen, the mayor and the police said, we're not going to take him. They left our town without permission, and he is not in our registration anymore, so ship him back. And that's exactly what they did. And so they decided in Kalantkote, which is where all this is, to bury him at the general cemetery. And he was and is the only Jew that it was there. The government took over the care of this grave, and they're doing a good job. About 2 years ago, I was there, and I had taken a group of people from the museum to all the places that were relevant to me, and because they were docents, they wanted to learn that. And so they came to the grave, and I asked them to say Kaddish, which is the prayer for the dead, because in a long time, nobody had come there and do that. And it was extremely moving and gratifying for me. And they all, you know, for Jews, you do not put flowers on graves. You put a stone. And it was so gratifying to see his grave with all these stones on it that somebody somewhere had thought about him. So after she found out what had happened, she had suddenly to deal with four kids who were all traumatized by what had happened to them. And she had been traumatized by what happened to her and her hiding. And then the Red Cross gave my mom the opportunity to send her kids to Sweden and Denmark and Switzerland. So she said, because she had a little cottage, that's what they had given her, to live in, and it was a lousy winter again, she was delighted to have the kids go. It wasn't a really warm atmosphere, but considering the circumstances that we had, I think my mom did a fantastic job. It was very hard on her. And the other thing happened that if there was anything on the radio about the war, my mom would get a migraine and go to bed and we wouldn't see her for 2 days. Well, that wasn't going to work for us. So we always shut everything out about the war. It was not a subject. And that was also the atmosphere in that whole country. Nobody talked about the war, because if you had been in the resistance, you had done things you weren't proud of, but you had to do. If you had been actually involved with the Germans and were collaborator of wars, you didn't want to talk about it because somebody, you know, you might get punished. And if you were a bystander and you hadn't done anything, you didn't want to talk about that either. And if you would have told me during those years that I would speak about this and about what happened to me, no chance. No chance that I would have done that. But, you know, as you grow up and as things start to settle down and as your curiosity gets the better of you, you start digging. You start finding out about yourself and about what happened and why. I still don't know why, but I know what happened. And I'm also very much interested in getting kids to realize that we as grown-ups have really not done a very good job as far as changing the world. We always said never again, and we lied. We really did. We didn't make it a better world. And now it is worse than it has ever been. And still, we all sit there and we don't do anything. I mean, it is really unforgivable that the U.S. has not let in more refugees from so many countries. Kids. And nobody does anything. We all say we find good reasons why we shouldn't get involved. So I'm looking at the younger generation because I say we just didn't do enough. And I'm saying with the kids that it starts with their own environment, that they have to be accepting of others. They have to stand up, we call that upstanders, for others who cannot defend themselves. And that should become a way of life. And if they started small, they will get to the bigger things once they learn to do that. And really, the only reason that I speak again and again and again, because I want to get that message through. Do something, for God's sake, do something. And especially you young people, go for it. Make this a better world. Thank you very much. Thank you.
You've been listening to a program from the Institute for Holocaust Education on Noon Forum. On this Holocaust Remembrance Day, we've heard a talk by Holocaust survivor Chaya Verveer, a board member of the Holocaust Museum Houston, a member of the Texas Holocaust and Genocide Commission, and president of Child Survivors of the Holocaust Houston. The title of her presentation was Improbable Survivor, A Young Child in the Holocaust. This program, co-sponsored by the Center for Faith Studies, was recorded by Omaha Public Radio on Thursday evening, March 6, 2014, for broadcast at this time. Special thanks to Liz Feldstern, Executive Director of the Institute for Holocaust Education, and Leslie Morrell, Interim Director of the Center for Faith Studies, for helping to make the recording and broadcast of this program possible. Complete Noon Forum listings, as well as an archive of over 300 previous broadcasts, are available on our website, kios.org. Now, this is your producer and host, Bob Cote, thanking you for listening.